it's a completely unexpected phenomena. And, you know, sadly, a lot of it's based on false information.
Coming up next on Amazing Discoveries, we're going to show you how to put magic in your kitchen with an exciting new kitchen tool called the Magic Wand. And now here's the host of Amazing Discoveries, Mike Levy.
Welcome, welcome. Hey, what would you say if I told you that you could make a yummy whipped dessert that only has 30 calories out of skim milk, but tastes just like a diet-breaking, calorie-laden mousse? What would you say?
I'd say you're absolutely crazy.
Well, it's possible. Bring out the dessert tray. Oh, it's Ian. What are you doing?
Oh,
Ian? Taste it. How's that taste?
Oh, really scrumptious.
Boy, they're eating it up. How's that taste?
Dr. Robin DiAngelo, thank you so much for doing the Tonight Show. I really appreciate it. I know how busy you are, and everyone wants to talk to you right now, so this means a lot to me. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
And thank you so much for having me.
Your book, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism, this came out in 2018?
Yes.
And it's been on the bestseller list ever since then?
It has, yes.
And right now, it is number one on all the lists I looked at, and it's also, from what I read, it's sold out everywhere as well.
An unfortunate time for it to be sold out, but yes.
Yeah. Well, here's what I did. I got it on Kindle.
Ah, okay.
I don't know if you saw this. It went viral online. A flight attendant was greeting people on her plane, and some gentleman came on, and he was reading your book. It opened up a whole conversation.
Yeah, I mean, glad you brought that up.
Glad you brought that up. Glad you brought that up.
How about an omelet? I'll just take a couple eggs. How many do you want?
Two.
Is good. Okay. And then what next?
Some ham.
Great.
Tomato.
Okay. How about that?
Okay. Some onion.
Ooh,
and cheese.
Everything then, right?
Okay,
you want
everything.
Okay. I understand. Okay. We'll just pop this on. Now watch. I'm chopping the ham and veggies, grating the cheese, and whipping the eggs all in 3 seconds. The machine that just made those smoothies for Berman and Fred will make an omelet. For you, Look at that.
Now, while that's cooking, can I interest anybody in any coffee?
Where's your coffee grinder?
I'll sit down and relax. We don't need a coffee grinder.
Sadly, because of our mistakes in diagnostics, our numbers got so large that even the states that made an effort, the benefits of the contact tracing wasn't gigantic. So it's really as you get down in, you know, lower infection rates, you know, like 3-4%. Then the contact tracing helps drive that down even lower.
When you look at that kind of disagreement or attack, do you see it as just ignorant or also malicious?
Mm-hmm. It's a self-contained unit. It's a professional machine.
No attachments to lose. Good.
See the dial on the side?
Mm-hmm.
That's all you need to do. You turn the dial. When it's set at number one, you're going to get a paper-thin slice.
Okay, number one's paper-thin.
Number two is wafer-thin.
Okay.
Number three and number four are medium slices.
Got it.
Number five and number six are thick slices.
Got it.
But look, Mike, turn to number seven. You see the blades appear?
How does one say, how does a white person say that they're not racist?
Well, white people often say, I'm not racist. I know you have. I have done things in my life I recognize as racist today. I would not do them again. They were neither intentional or even conscious, and yet they wounded other people nonetheless. I think white people should remove that phrase from their vocabulary. I'm not racist. It's not, trust me, it's not convincing to black people. As long as we define racism as individual, intentional acts of meanness, then I would agree with you that most white people are not racist. But when I'm talking about the racism that I have, the racism that you have, it's the result of living in a society in which racism is the foundation. We all absorb it. We all absorb it. There's no way we could exempt ourselves from it. And so we need to change our question from, if I'm racist, to which most white people will say no, to how have I been shaped by the forces of racism I was born into, and how is it manifesting in my life? It's a really different question.
Yeah.
But if I asked if and the answer is no, what further action is required of me to challenge racism? Nothing. I'm not racist.
So where can white people start?
Well, before I went clear, my career was going okay, but it wasn't anywhere near where I really wanted it to be. It's like I had all these dreams of these goals that I wanted to accomplish in my life. I mean, big plans. I wanted to do a one-woman show, and I want to star in a series, and I mean, it's like big things to take on. And they were just dreams. But after I went clear, I got rid of this reactive mind thing. The next thing I know, I'm totally opened up. My abilities increased tenfold. And now it's like, I look back on that and I say, well, gee whiz, I went clear about 4 years ago and I started putting these things into action. And I look at where I am now, I'm doing things that I never thought I could do before.
Because there's a lot on the internet, the stuff that's not true, we're not giving airtime to, but that tries to rope you into something.
Yeah, so both myself and Dr. Fauci have featured in conspiracy theories. You know, like one says that Dr. Fauci's trying to make money off of these vaccines and various negative things about me. There, you're encouraging people not to trust the advice on masks or taking the vaccine, and that could be damaging. It's a new phenomena. I don't know, you know, will it hurt the vaccine uptake where everyone who takes the vaccine is not just protecting themselves, but reducing their transmission to other people and allowing society to get back to normal. You know, so it's a completely unexpected phenomena. And, you know, sadly, a lot of it's based on false information.
Yeah, I just have one follow-up on that, which is, you're known to be both effective and an optimist. What do you say to people who look at this and feel like scientists, experts, and you warned and gave the public information, and by your own assessment today, it still didn't go very well?
So hearing comments like these have real sway with some people out there. A new poll this week shows that 43% of Republicans still don't want to get the vaccine. How frustrating is this for you, Dr. Fauci?
You know, Dana, it is quite frustrating.
Boy, they're eating it up. How's it taste?
I mentioned this a few times before, this contentious interview that Chomsky had with a reporter. They're talking about manufacturing consent. The reporter says to Chomsky, all right, well, so you're saying I'm lying, I'm a liar, I'm deceiving people? And Chomsky goes, oh, no, I think you totally believe what you're saying. But if you stopped believing what you were saying, or you started to question what you're saying, you would be replaced. It's like a Pez dispenser of useful idiot. How many people with journalism degrees are serving people coffee? It's competitive, and there is a yes man waiting in your shadow if you start asking questions about anything that you're doing. And that's, I think, one of the sicknesses of mass media. Welcome to Emotional Manipulators for Hire, Episode 9. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, Brett. How's it going?
Oh, it's going well. It's a beautiful day here in Pittsburgh. I'm looking out a window. I talked about this in the monologue for a show I put out just yesterday, that in this new place I live, I can see a good, 7-8 miles just looking right out my window. And last night it was Memorial Day and there were fireworks going off in the distance. I've just been sitting here looking out the window at the beautiful spring, almost summer day here in Pittsburgh. So yes, that's a long way of saying I'm doing well. How are things there in Colorado?
Good. We had a bunch of rain over the last week, but now today it's nice and sunny. And as soon as we get off of this call, I'm actually going for a motorcycle ride. So
I have rollerblades too. And I keep thinking that I'm going to take those out and roll around the city in them. I feel like that's something I should let people know. That might be happening soon too. We're going to start in Arizona. You wanted to talk about the OK Corral, and I thought that was interesting. What is it about the OK Corral that relates to what we're talking about today?
So people think about the Wild West. We think about like TV shows that were about the Wild West. We think about stories of the Wild West. We think about the history of America and the Wild West. And things like the shootout at the OK Corral are kind of like what paint the entire picture for most people. You think about the Wild West and you're like, oh yeah, gunfights and bank robberies and bandits. And that's what people think the Wild West was like. But the truth of the matter is, the reason why the shootout at the OK Corral is such a famous story is because it was such a rare event. Stuff like that didn't happen very often. So it made a huge impact because it was like shocking. And at the time, people were like, this kind of stuff never happens. Mm. But all of those stories of the boring days where nothing happened, they don't make the news.
Exactly. Still true 140 years later. Yeah, it's interesting. Do you know how long the whole shootout at the OK Corral lasted?
I don't.
30 seconds. So it's 30 seconds that defined the West in a lot of ways. And if people have seen the movie, let's see, Tombstone and Wyatt Earp, that movie probably deals. There's probably a whole bunch of Hollywood movies that cover the Tombstone, Arizona story. But people who know the story of the Earp brothers and Doc Holliday know that even that event that only lasted 30 seconds and happened in 1881 was years and years of bad blood buildup and power struggle in that territory that ended in a 30-second shootout, not at the OK Corral, as a matter of fact. It was actually, this is interesting, considering that it was 1881. It actually happened in this like a open lot adjacent to a photography studio.
Okay. So basically the moral of the story is, by selectively picking what it is we pay attention to, it can have a huge distortion on what people perceive as reality. And this is a particular example, but as you just mentioned, this kind of stuff still happens to this day, where we pay extra attention to some things and they have a higher precedence or a higher value of reality than other things, which might happen more often. And we'll get into a bunch of examples in this episode, but I just kind of wanted to start off with acknowledging the fact that people's reality is usually based on what they pay attention to or what is being presented to them more than what's actually going on around them, and how that is used by the media to kind of direct movements and mass movements and decision making, and how it can also be used by business owners and marketers to do the same thing for their audience as well.
Yeah, I would add, and this is something that we're going to talk about as well, it's not just used by media. Like, the people who inhabit the media are very, very susceptible to this too, right? Existing in a kind of echo chamber, depending on where they work, they are victims, and you know, there's definitely a spiraling effect as you know, it works out to the manipulation or the shaping of public opinion. They are subject to this themselves, but then they kind of inflict it on other people, because there's this misperception that, well, the media, the people in media, know something, and they don't. You know, like, a lot of times, like, Matt, I want to talk about this article that Matt Taibbi just wrote, but it was like, it was on Substack, and it was like, fact checking takes another beating. And he put fact checking in quotes, which I loved. These people don't know shit. And once you come to, in this very polarized and tribal world, themes that we've talked about before, trust a source of information, you as the viewer or the consumer of so-called information will completely overlook the fact and ignore examples of this person repeatedly proving to you, if you want to see it, that they have no idea what they're talking about. And they're almost always wrong. But, you know, the people in media have a lot of clever dodges for that. And we'll talk about a couple. I do want to get into that Taibbi article. But yeah, obviously, over the last 15 months or so, we've seen a really powerful and I would say tragic example of availability bias and, you know, cherry picking information, events, scientific data. But this is obviously something that's going to spill into really, really consequential areas of life beyond so-called journalism, like medical advice, you know, diagnoses. A lot of times doctors are assessing people and then making decisions based on widely publicized studies. Financial advice. You remember when, like, Jim Cramer and people like that got in trouble around the 2008 financial crisis, where these people who had a very selective picture were giving people, and even as viewers, an even more selective picture. And this allowed them to have influence, or the people influencing them, over entire financial markets, and really narrowing people's options in finances, in medical freedom, and obviously in the acquisition of information through journalism. So those are three big, very pervasive examples of how availability bias, without people even knowing, maybe in some cases, that they're subject to it, can wind up hurting a lot of people down the line.
Yeah. And just to kind of get into what availability bias is, we all have to make decisions. We all try to make those decisions with the best information at hand. But a lot of times, the best information isn't total knowledge of everything involved. A lot of times, there can be 80 facts out there, and we can find 4 of them, or maybe we can find 60 of them. And to your point, if the media or wherever you're trusting to go get your facts from, if they have an agenda and they want to influence you, they can pull out the facts that go against what they're trying to convince you and just make sure you don't see those. So you're making your decision without those facts available to your data collecting processes. And there's a lot of power in that. There's a lot of power in saying they come to me for their facts, and I get to pick and choose which facts they see and they get to consider in their decision making.
Yeah. And I do want to actually get into this Taibbi article, and this is a good place, because the effect that this has too is like, whoa, you have a question. Like once this takes hold, as it has with the, 24-hour news and news as more of a business than it used to be, now, and again, this combines with things being so tribal. If you have a question, not only are you crazy, like about an official narrative, you need to be shamed. And we see these people who are so self-righteous and sanctimonious, literally setting the parameters of almost every debate on every issue with, like I said before, no information, right? And Taibbi says in the article, and I thought this was a great line, that like certainty is the worst form of misinformation. Certainty is the worst form of misinformation. But if you are, in this availability bias world, where obviously this has become not only like dangerous, it has become a tool. So like to cherry pick things like unconsciously or engage in availability bias unconsciously, that's one step. But now, because news is so narrative driven and so politically motivated or politically biased, and that goes, both ways, you almost have cherry picking used as a tool to create a story. Right. So and that's accepted. And one of the reasons why that's so dangerous is it's almost accepted practice in media to use cherry picking. And it's like, oh, we already reassured ourselves by like we are the purveyors of truth and information and we're defending democracy and whatever they tell themselves. But they're using a cognitive bias as their primary tool in assembling narratives. And I don't think most of them even know that that's a problem because it's never been pointed out.
Partially. I go back and forth on whether it's deliberate or
I do
it's
too, just yeah.
We all kind of, because the fact is I fall victim to these. Sometimes, I guess at a deeper level, cognitive dissonance and confirmation bias, I fall victim to them. They're built into everybody's thinking processes. And maybe the people writing the scripts for the talking heads also fall victim to these same things. But then just speaking about the last year, I guess it's safe now to talk about the lab leak theory, whereas for the last 15 months, you were kicked off of social media and had your accounts shut down for even suggesting it. But the evidence was there all along, or the possibility and the need for a discussion around these things have been there all along. Same thing with recently, Project Veritas broke a story about Facebook censoring posts of people who were talking about negative reactions that they had from getting the vaccines. And Facebook would see those and they would shadow ban them, or they would decrease the visibility of posts like that. some of these things are conscious decisions. They're saying, we don't want this being part of the narrative. We don't want people having this information when they make their decisions about things. So sometimes, yes, I think that it's just, we fall victim to these things, and the news broadcasters and the people writing their scripts fall victim to them too.
Yeah.
But there's more and more evidence, especially surrounding the whole narrative of the coronavirus that we've been dealing with for the last year. There's more and more evidence that these have been conscious decisions, that people have been consciously deciding which facts are allowed to be in the public sphere of knowledge and which ones are supposed to remain kind of in the shadows. And I don't think that that's just I'm falling victim to this confirmation bias and it's spreading to my viewers. I think that there's a lot of stuff coming out now that indicates that there have been some deliberate decisions to control which information is available for people.
Right. And that's why I would say I go back and forth, because I just think it's important to parse it within the different levels of media. Like, are you a reporter? Are you a news anchor? There, as we know from the schooling system and the higher education system, there is no shortage of useful idiots. There is no shortage of true believers. So whether it comes to, you know, the whole follow the science is religion, scientism crowd, or the social justice crowd, there's no shortage of people who don't even realize they're useful idiots. They're true believers. There's no shortage of obedient people. There's no shortage of conformist people. And those people work on, you know, the ground level of that, almost with this kind of plausible deniability. Like they don't even think they're lying, right? Because what else could you believe and not need to be locked away in an asylum? And I also remember, I mentioned this a few times before, this contentious interview that Chomsky had with a reporter on the big three, one of the big three news networks. And the reporter, they're talking about manufacturing consent. And he basically says, the reporter says to Chomsky, all right, well, so you're saying I'm lying, I'm a liar, I'm deceiving people. And Chomsky goes, oh no, I think you totally believe what you're saying. But if you stopped believing what you were saying, or you started to question what you're saying, you would be replaced. It's like a Pez dispenser of useful idiots. And people know that. And Taibbi has actually talked about that quite a bit. Jimmy Dore talks about it. Glenn Greenwald talks about it, where it's like Chris Hedges is another example, somebody who was on one of the, you know, was in mainstream media and became very vocal against U.S. foreign policy when everybody kind of had to sing off the same song sheet around the Iraq war. These people know that, you know, if you start thinking for yourself and you become a problem, like nonconformist, disobedient, there is somebody who wants that job badly. There's a lot of prestige, right, and access that comes from working in that industry, especially, you know, how many people with journalism degrees are serving people coffee? It's competitive, and there is a useful idiot yes man waiting in your shadow if you start asking questions about anything that you're doing. And that's, I think, part of one of the sicknesses of mass media.
Yeah. And over the last year, we've seen how pervasive it can be in forming people's realities. I mean, one of the simple things to look at is what we're dealing with right now. By the most recent records that I've seen, has a 99.98 survival rate. It's a 0.02 mortality rate, which is not that concerning. I mean, it's obviously, it kills people, but it's not Captain Trips from Stephen King's The Stand. Like, mm-hmm. But a lot of people think that it is. A lot of people, I know people that are fully vaccinated and they still won't leave their house without a mask because they think this is killing. I saw something where they recently interviewed or did a poll, and a lot of Americans thought that this thing had already killed hundreds of millions of Americans.
Jeez.
Yeah. And it was an overwhelming majority of people that were polled by this particular news agency that also pushes that idea that this thing is way more deadly than it actually is. So by only focusing on, by hyper-focusing on the 0.02% of people that die from it and completely ignoring the 99.98% that don't die from it, you have a bunch of people who are thinking this thing is a lot more deadly than it actually is. And whether it's for ratings, whether it's because the people doing it are actually as afraid of it as they're trying to whip their audience up into being, or whether it has to do with the fact that 73% of their sponsorship ad money comes from the pharmaceutical industry and they want to make sure that they're giving those companies a good return on their investment. Whatever the motive is, by hyper-focusing on the 0.02% and ignoring the 99.98%, their audience is living in a distorted reality. And that is, again, whether it's deliberate or whether it's just a reaction of their own thinking, we have people that live in completely unrealistic versions of reality. And it's really easy to put people in that if you can control and cherry pick and have power over what information is available to them and what information is hidden from them.
Yeah. And again, I think that bringing the pharmaceutical companies into it, talking about their sponsorship of at least the major networks, but it extends well beyond that, is important, because people who are responsible for the actual dissemination of information and think they're reporters, they only have to be told a noble tale of what they're doing. And I'll insert some of this Taibbi article right here, because it's around fact checking, which is it's just so funny. You know, here we are to check the facts. Right. And what most of the article is about actually relates to the Wuhan stuff and the lab leak, where it's like, oh, yeah, you ate shit on this, checking facts. And like Tucker Carlson, at least like this was a while back, but he conjectured about like, all right, well, what do we know about Wuhan? And he got hashtag stop Asian hate for even suggesting that. And the fact checkers were sicked on the Tucker Carlson show and said this was false, and then they quietly had to withdraw that. And that made news, and Tucker Carlson did a victory lap about it. But yeah, I want to share a couple paragraphs and just get your thoughts, and I think it kind of builds this out a little bit more. I really enjoyed this. And it relates to COVID, obviously, too. So Taibbi is talking about objectivity. He continues on to fact-checking by saying, like fact-checking itself, the on the one hand and on the other hand format is just a defense mechanism. These people say X, these people say Y, and because the jabbering mannequins we have reading off our teleprompters actually know Jack, we'll let the passage of time sort out the difficult bits. So I think what he's saying there, to apply that to our memories, there was a time, like you and I are old enough to remember watching the news and understanding the person sitting behind the desk was reading information that came from somewhere else, right? That they were not the seer of all truth. And that understanding, I think, has like faded away more. And like people aren't even questioning what is, because everything is so, you know, tribal and biased now, too. They're not even questioning those things. But I think that they understood that that was a person who was reading something, who was reading cue cards or teleprompters. And, you know, that's not the way it works anymore. And he mentions that, continuing, the public used to appreciate the humility of that approach. But what they get from us more often now are sanctimonious speeches about how reporters are intrepid seekers of truth who sit next to God and gobble amphetamines so they can stay awake all night defending democracy from misinformation. But once you get past names, dates, and whether the sky was blue or cloudy, the worst kind of information in journalism is to be too sure about anything. That's especially when dealing with complex technical issues, and even more especially when official sources seem invested in eliminating discussion of alternative scenarios of those issues, right? So then you start to see the hierarchy emerge very quickly in that second paragraph, where somebody might think they're doing their job, but because of the cherry picking that might have happened at the editorial stage, right, where it's like, this is all forbidden territory. Again, back to the plausible deniability of the person presenting the information, they're a victim of availability bias because the box has already been created for them to be in, right? By whoever works above them. So, you know, then he continues, but you can see how this spirals when some of the other themes that we've talked about in Emotional Manipulators for Hire, again, back to tribalism, come into this. So he says, from the start, the press mostly mishandled COVID-19 reporting. Part of this was because nearly all of the critical issues, mask use, lockdowns, viability of vaccine programs, and so on, were marketed by news companies as culture war narratives. A related problem had to do with news companies using the misguided notion that the news is an exact science to promote the worst misconception that science is an exact science. This led to absurd spectacles, like news agencies trying to cover up or denounce as falsehood the natural reality that officials had evolving views on things like the efficacy of ventilators or mask use. So, and then it goes on to talk more about like CNN has to fact check Dr. Fauci, and they're worried about saying that, oh yeah, Dr. Fauci got this wrong. So in their fact check, they have to emphasize that Trump is, he says, emphasizing that Trump is an asshole is more important to kind of almost cover up that, yes, Dr. Fauci got this thing wrong, because he is pitted as like this anti-Trump hero in this whole thing, which is, again, there's availability bias there. There's all these things about Dr. Fauci that you can't know about. And a lot of it relates to this Wuhan thing that we're talking about. But that is all outside of that box. It's forbidden information. And people, like I played clips of these kinds of people who almost have like, a religious understanding of this man. Like, how dare you question him? He's never made a mistake. He's never engaged in anything shady. Like, that's all off the table because it's, you know, it's hidden. And you know, he's talking in this article about CNN is basically subject to the same thing. Tribalism is a part of that too, that I think exacerbates the cherry picking and availability bias problems. And we understand that. Like, I understand that as the producer of this show that has a narrative, that has a point of view. And yeah, it really slows things down when you look at data or you find a study or you hear an opinion that contradicts like where you were going. Like midstream, I've been creating a show and then something, occurs to me. I really try to be honest about it and express uncertainty when it exists, but it sucks. Like when I think I have a clear line through something that's going to be a really powerful presentation, and then there's like a major speed bump, I feel like I could get away with that more than people who have millions of people watching them. But I actually feel, because of who my audience is, I would be called out on that more by a thinking audience than by people who are kind of like going through this ritual of like, I'm absorbing information and getting smarter, when all it really is people on television are telling me what I want to hear, because they don't usually know any better either.
I think there's two things to that. Number one, I have probably most of our listeners right now have a little bit of integrity when it comes to, here's what I believe. Oh, here's some new information that frames it in a new light. Maybe I should readjust what I believe about that, or maybe I should consider that when trying to promote what I believe. I think that for a lot of the mainstream media people, when they come across those truths, they either quickly turn a blind eye to them, sweep them back under the rug. And maybe it's because, like you mentioned, if I say this, maybe I get fired, maybe I'm replaced, maybe I'm biting the hand that feeds me, or maybe it's just, again, back to our own personal flaws. We don't want to deal with the fact that we might be wrong about something. But you mentioned the fact checkers and the there's been kind of a meme that's going around right now where it's like the scientists all agree, and then one scientist steps up and says, I actually disagree. And so the solution is censor that scientist, silence him.
Yes.
And now we're back to the scientists all agree. And we saw this a lot over the last year, where there was certain facts that you just weren't allowed to talk about. And this is becoming increasingly more pervasive in other areas of life. There's, when it comes to the climate debate, there's certain scientists that you're just not allowed to talk about. There's certain research that you're just not allowed to talk about. When it comes to statistics of things involving race and crime and police interactions, there's certain interactions that are totally okay to talk about all day long. And then there's certain interactions that you're not allowed to talk about. They never make the news. There's certain statistics that you're allowed to talk about all day long. There's other statistics that you're not allowed to mention at all. Otherwise, you'll get called all these different kinds of bigoted names. And so, and this is more and more, there's more and more this mentality of, we're not allowed to have open discussion. We're only allowed to look at one set of facts. We're only allowed to look at one. We're only allowed to look at the statistics and the facts and the scientific research that backs up one side of the argument. And we're not allowed to talk about the points that the other side of the argument has. And this, it used to be with just certain key issues, but now it seems to be spreading to more and more aspects of life. And it seems like there's more and more areas where you're only allowed to have one opinion. And if you have contrary points of view, or if you have actual facts that might negate that opinion, you run afoul of the algorithms, you get censored, you get shadow banned, you get your channels completely removed from the platforms, you get your profiles locked and shut down, and you get attacked by the fact checkers, even though the fact checkers are wrong and you're right. And it seems to be a growing problem that this is becoming a more and more prevalent part of communication in society right now.
Well, I think it's especially dangerous when it is coupled with perception of legitimacy or something that is like a power center of information and influence. So we spent a lot of time talking about the media. But gosh, when you talk about a lot of social issues, it's hard to overlook the impact of higher ed, right? Because all of those aggrievement studies, availability bias and cherry picking is basically the fuel that they run on. While, you know, being presented as like, welcome to such and such university, a place for knowledge and truth seekers, where, you know, we have reliable and trustworthy, responsible guides, but they are given a very, very narrow picture of the world. And there are, like I've said about, you know, there were people 5 years ago who were criticizing me for saying, you're a little obsessed with what's going on in these dumb programs in colleges around the country. And I said, I'm not telling this story to present myself as a prophet here, but my response at the time was like, well, you know, in the 1900s and 1910s, there were a bunch of like utopian progressives with a very clear design on this country who nobody was paying attention to. And look what we got. You know, I've been at that point, I've been doing a show criticizing what we got for like 6 or 7 years. Obviously now, I wasn't the only person saying this in 2015 or 2016, but all of these nuts, they're going to graduate and then they're going to do something else. And a lot of them are in the media, right? That's where a lot of them went. And a lot of them also are in education. And that's maybe one of the reasons why we hear more and more of these indoctrination stories at the elementary school level on like these kinds of social justice issues. But it also another, I mean, obviously the real power center those people want to get to is the political. And, you know, whether it's in our own lives, our own perceptions, or all the way scaled up to public policy, people, because of them falling prey to availability bias, which again is natural and we all do it. It is a heuristic. Daniel Kahneman talked about it over 40 years ago. Daniel Kahneman, who wrote Thinking Fast and Slow, and the thinking fast, the shortcut thinking, the survival-based thinking requires a bunch of heuristics to be able to make fast decisions. So obviously, like, we are prone, just naturally, biologically, we are prone to a availability bias. So we shouldn't, I don't want to frame it as like a conspiracy used against people, but it can be harnessed, like we talked about in the media and also in higher education, as a way to manipulate people and to manipulate information. And the result, back to the public policy and how people live their lives and what they choose to look at, I think this is really, really tragic when you see people doing it in their personal lives, but they wind up investing a lot of resources. So those resources on the society scale could be money, like tax money, and on the personal scale could be like emotion and attention. They invest a lot of resources in things that are actually minor problems, but because of the framing, they have been led to believe that these are the only problems or the biggest problems because of the amount of exposure that they have to them. If you are in higher education, I don't want to just say you're getting a degree in gender studies. At this point, you could be in biology and you're getting a lot of the same shit in a biology program. It has infected way more than just the social sciences, the social justice narratives. And that is blown up into like, you know, such a big thing and such a big problem in the world. Yeah, it's really going to distort people's perception of the world as it actually is. And it exacerbates, I think, division and tribalism and just general acrimony in society because of the availability bias perception that people walk away with. They say, this is the biggest problem. This is the biggest problem. As people are pushed further and further apart, people on the other side aren't saying, well, it's a problem, but it's not the biggest problem. They go, shut the fuck up, idiot. It's not a problem at all. You think about the tragedy of something like racism, just racial injustice as it relates to police or as it relates to economic inequality. And there are real problems, like even why do men make more money than women? There's something there worth talking about. But if you're hard on one side of the issue, I actually got lost the other day having this conversation in a car with somebody about the gender pay gap. And I looked up and I went, where the hell are we? Because I got real into it. There are so many missed opportunities and lost opportunities. And I would say, as far as the left is concerned, a lot of this is intentional. A lot of it, what availability bias does is it removes the middle. It removes middle ground. And I remember Stefan Molyneux, when he got banned from YouTube, he's like, well, I'm the rational middle. And, you know, maybe you think he is and maybe you think he's not. But it was a really good point that he made, where it's like, if society is being pushed apart in these polarized directions, yeah, you want the bridges to be burned between disparate points of view. And when it comes to something like the gender pay gap, people are given this explanation on the one extreme that this is just, you know, about injustice and unfairness. And it's fallen out of my vocabulary because we don't talk about it. The patriarchy is such a 2 years ago thing to say, but it was big 2 years ago and we're on to other things now. But like all of these framings of it push people on the other side not to go, well, OK, yeah, there's something real to look at there. Like, what are the choices that if you take all employed men between the ages of 24 and 46 and all employed women in the same age group, and you do see that the men make more, why? And is there something that we could learn that would actually help women from that? None of that is available. The person is pushed to saying, nope, that's bullshit. That's not real. That's just social justice, blah, blah, blah. And it's another problem that's not solved. So this has, I think, some really, really devastating consequences just when it comes to the actual cohesion of society and, like, you know, racial justice. But we've seen how all of these narratives were applied to science now, where science is completely politicized because of what has happened. It was on its way before with climate change, but it really went off a cliff in the last 15 months with COVID.
So the way that I kind of see all of this stuff is like a jigsaw puzzle, and you can be putting a puzzle together and you can be looking at it and you're 80% done with it. And you can be like, okay, this is what this puzzle is. The picture that it's going to put together is this, and you can have a really good idea of what the puzzle is going to be. But then you find those other 20% of the pieces and fit them into place. And you're like, oh wait, this is a completely different picture than what I thought. And sometimes it's just one puzzle piece. And once that one puzzle piece falls into place, oh, this is totally different than what I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be a painting of mountains, but this is actually a city skyline or something like that. Having those missing puzzle pieces can completely change the way that you look at something. And being able to withhold those puzzle pieces can give your audience a feeling of certainty, even though they're completely wrong. They can be certain that they're looking at a painting of mountains. And if you withhold those 8 or 9 puzzle pieces that expose that it's actually a painting of the moon or something like that, by being able to hide those puzzle pieces, you can have your audience living in an alternate reality. And again, I don't want to attribute malice where ignorance might be the case, but being a marketer, I know that sometimes malice is the case. I know that sometimes it is. I've worked with people that had no problem deliberately withholding those extra puzzle pieces that would completely change your point of view on what you were looking at. And I can't imagine marketers are the only people that do this. I imagine that educators do it. I imagine that news people do it. You were talking about higher education and social justice issues. One particular thing that comes to mind for me is our perception of slavery. Our perception of slavery is it was something that horrible white people did to victimize Black people. And then once you start looking at the more nuanced aspects of it, you realize, oh, white people have also been slaves. Oriental people, are we allowed to say Oriental people? Asian people were also slaves. Black people also owned slaves. Every group of people has been slaves. Every group of people has also owned slaves. But you're not fed those puzzle pieces. You're only fed the puzzle pieces that say Black people were the victims and white people were the oppressors. And you can have this very certain view of history with 80% of the puzzle pieces. And once you go out and find those other 20%, then you're like, there's a lot of subtleties to this that I didn't understand before. But if you don't ever go out and find those other 20% of the puzzle pieces, it's very easy to be absolute and steadfast and certain in your opinion. And I think a lot of times the people that dole out information deliberately hide certain puzzle pieces in order to get the effect of their audience going out and acting in certainty in a completely erroneous fashion.
I bet you made some good points there, but I stopped listening to you after you said Oriental and hashtag stop Oriental hate, Nathan. Those are great points. And, you know, as a somebody who creates and purveys information, you know, I ask this question a lot because I go through everything I do first, like on, you know, the edit, and then I try to listen back to things after I release them and just pretend I'm a person who didn't create it and you know, try to critically analyze it as an audience member. And I often think like, what's my responsibility as far as these puzzle pieces are concerned? And am I like hand in hand with the person that I'm interviewing too much in agreement? And I think that's one of the biggest criticisms of my presentation is I haven't, when people come to present ideas, I haven't been the sharpening stone enough for those ideas. My last guest, this young man, Noah, 24 years old, he's talking about going out into this world and promoting the idea of free market education versus government schooling. And I said, get out there and get with people you disagree with. You have models of how you want things to work. Give them to your enemies, right? Let them, you know, have at them. I think that's really important. That's not something that I did enough in the early stages of what I was doing because there was such a substantial bubble, you know, to be in at that time. Like you had all of these really, really intelligent and assured people reinforcing your belief system. And everything was so new. So it's just like, yeah, I'm discovering Free Talk Live and Fee and Mises and Stefan Molyneux and all, you know, all these sources of information that you really, really felt emboldened. And I think, you know, as I've kind of gone out more on my own as a thinker, and I listen to the ways that I present information on the show, I say, man, I don't know what my responsibility is as far as like giving people a bunch of puzzle pieces, but sometimes I feel like I'm not providing enough, right? It's like Isaac Morehouse said, all news is fake news. You're never getting the full picture of anything that you're consuming. Everything is there's critics of the availability bias. There are other psychologists and communications theorists who say Kenneman is full of shit. And the naming of the bias is just a heuristic in itself. So, and we left that out of the conversation, but this is something that there's been critics of for like 40 years. And we could, you know, we could ascribe motive or malice to them for saying this isn't a real thing. But at the very least, it is a useful shortcut and heuristic for understanding a very common type of human behavior. But back to the puzzle pieces and my criticism of myself as a presenter, one of the best ways to give people a fuller puzzle with smaller pieces is to ask follow-up questions. And I think this is actually a really, really useful tip to identify as a consumer of information how subject to availability bias you might be at any given time. So I'll listen to something that a guest says, right? And I'll say, why didn't I push back on that? Or why didn't I ask for elaboration? And I've learned this from watching like mainstream media where they never do this. If anybody wants to have a frustrating afternoon, Katie Couric interviews Richard Haass, who was the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, and it is a goddamn infomercial. And that stuck out like 10 years ago, like that was more visible. But now in news and public opinion manipulation, everything is an infomercial. Nathan, you know that I talk a lot about these late night comedy shows, as they're called, Jimmy Kimmel, Stephen Colbert, and you watch the interviews that these people do. There is not a follow-up question. There is not a critical question to be found anywhere. I remember when I was a kid and I would watch the show called Amazing Discoveries. And there would be this guy. He was kind of a dork, but he was like playing the curious and incredulous, like, will that really get grape juice out of a carpet? I don't believe it. And then there was this this knowing, kind of fun but trustworthy seeming British guy who was presenting all the products. And the whole setup was the interviewer would just basically guide the interviewee through the talking points, and any follow-up questions would be entirely absent. On the spectrum of like the hardest hitting interview you've ever heard to amazing discoveries, I've tried to like plot myself as an interviewer for School Sucks, like where am I? And that's become, I think, more of a concern watching just the synthetic quality of not only, you know, mainstream media, but a lot of these late night comedy shows that are actually infomercials for mainstream media narratives in many ways. So I think just a useful kind of hack for people who are considering their own susceptibility to availability bias and cherry picking is to, like, if you're going along with somebody and you, or you're listening to an interview and you feel, oh, this is a really good conversation. Yes, 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 I agree with that. How much of a sharpening stone effect is going on? How many follow-up questions are there? How much pushback do you see? Is it a real discussion or is it a presentation with a clear endpoint in mind? Is it an exploration, right? Or is it pushing you in a very specific direction?
Yes to all of that. I think actually, I heard on your podcast one time you said something, and this is, it was like, yes, Brett gets it. You said something about if I'm listening to something or I'm watching something or I'm reading something and it's firing all of the pleasure triggers. It's all of the, yep, that's what I believe. Yep. That's what I believe. One of the things that I do is I go and I try and find somebody who's got a different opinion.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's enough of that. I don't think that enough people do that. And there's a lot of reasons why, and I don't know, that could be an entirely different episode of the show. But the fact of the matter is, whether it's the person being interviewed, I mean, if I'm going to interview you and you come on my show and I start asking you hard questions, it's going to be hard to get you to come back on the show. So there's that incentive. If I want to have you back on the show, if I want to have you recommend your friends to come on the show, I don't want to make you look like a fool in front of my audience. I want to make you look awesome in front. And then that's just one of the things, one of the rules of interviewing people in the first place is make sure that your guest looks smart and awesome for your audience. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are marketing. And I think this would be a good time to kind of pivot and look at how some of this stuff is used in marketing, if you're okay with
that. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I was kind of curious about how to take this in a positive direction, as I usually am in these conversations. So yes, please.
So I'm not sure we're going to take it in a positive direction. I'm just going to, without judgment, lay out some of the ways that some of these realities about the way that cherry picking and availability bias, how they work in marketing, how you can take advantage of them. Again, I don't know if this is positive. I don't know if this is negative. I'm just laying it out there for you to decide.
It is always, I will just say, it is always positive to call things into existence, right? The first step to doing better with anything is like recognizing its existence. So if people like cherry picking, I think is a pretty like common phrase in our vernacular, but I don't think people understand the depths of it. Right. And I think people could, if you explain to availability bias to them, which is basically, you know, cherry picking is kind of the action that follows the problem of availability bias. I think they'd go, yeah, that's not like an inconceivable idea that you're putting forward. I can see examples of me doing that, but I think to make an exercise of looking for it, not just around you, but, you know, in yourself is the important first step. So I would say it's a positive in marketing to just to see how it works, to understand how it works is turning this positive. On that note, this has been a very positive show.
So one of the first examples that I would draw people's attention to is what they call sock puppets. And a lot of times, a lot of bigger corporations, they hire people just to go out on social media and run 3 or 4 accounts and make it look like a particular point of view is more prevalent than it is. So Pepsi will hire people to create 30 different sock puppet accounts. And every time they'll go into Twitter or they'll go into Facebook and they'll look for somebody saying, I love Coca-Cola, it's the best. And they'll have people that all they do is they log into one account and they go under that and they comment, I don't know, I like Pepsi better. And then they'll log into their second account and they'll say, yeah, Pepsi is way better than Coke. And then they'll log into their third account and they'll be like, yeah, I had a bad experience with Coke, and so now I only drink Pepsi. And you'll see this in Amazon reviews. A lot of times people are buying Amazon reviews from sock puppet accounts now. You'll see this on Audible. If you go look at the reviews for a lot of books, a lot of the reviews are, this book was very good for someone who is interested in title of the book. You should read this book. It was very good book. Mm-hmm. And they're buying these, there's services where you can go and buy sock puppets to go and bombard your book or your product with positive. Or on the other hand, you can bombard your competition's book or your competition's Amazon page with negative sock puppet reviews. And this is something that we also see people do in activism. I've personally known people, maybe it wasn't nefarious at first, but they get their Facebook account shut down. So they start up another Facebook account. That one gets shut down. Now all of a sudden they have three Facebook accounts. Now when they get in an argument with somebody, they can log out of their one account and log in as another account and be like, yeah, that guy who's really me was right and you're wrong.
Oh, man. Have you ever caught anyone doing that? I mean, I've heard about that, but have you ever caught anyone actually doing that?
I've been suspicious of it happening. I know that it happens, though. I've known people that admit that they do it, and I know marketers that it's part of their strategy. So as far as like political discussion goes, I'm sure it happens. I haven't red-handed caught somebody, but I don't really get engaged in that kind of conversation more than just shit posting nowadays anyways. But it's a great example of what's available to me when I'm looking at the reviews or when I'm looking at the discussion. What's available is one person says this and eight people, who's really one person, but it looks like eight people have this other opinion. So that other opinion has more weight to it because that's what's more available. So you can easily use availability bias to mold what a consumer or what a spectator who's watching a discussion go on between whether Pepsi is better or Coke is better. You can use sock puppet accounts to make your point of view more available, so it holds more weight for the person reading or scrolling through the reviews.
Yeah, so it couples with a fallacy, like the appeal to popular opinion.
Yeah. Another example is what we call native advertising. Mm-hmm. Native advertising is where it doesn't look like an advertisement. Product placement is an example of native advertising. Having somebody not fully disclose when they're doing an ad read on their podcast is an example of native advertising. A lot of times news stories are native advertising, where it's presented as, and you'll see this in magazines, where it looks like it's an article, and then at the very bottom of the page, you see advertisement written in fine print. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, on actual news broadcasts, there's examples of native advertising. Oh, Sally, tell us about this new product that you found for taking care of your dog's fleas this summer. And it looks like it's a story, but it's actually the flea powder company said, hey, can you make this look? It's a press release disguised as a piece of journalism. And again, this is presenting a... going back to the news, it's presenting 80% of the puzzle pieces in the form of news, and people walk away thinking, oh, I've got the full picture, but they don't realize that it wasn't actually investigative journalism. It was a form of native advertising. So native advertising is another great way to stack the information in your favor. And another example of this, and I'm going to get into conspiracy theory land here, but there's stories about technology that can get you 80 to 100 miles per gallon of gasoline in your car, a new type of carburetor or a new type of fuel or a new type of battery that would decimate the petroleum industry. And so what do? They buy the technology, they patent it, and then they put it on the shelf so that nobody can sell it. Or there's inside of the medical industry, there's natural cures that they don't want you to know about, that you could grow this thing in your backyard and it could cure this big problem, but then it would mean a huge financial dent for the pharmaceutical companies. So they buy it, they patent it, And they say, we don't sell this. It's not allowed to be sold. So the only one that's sold is the one that's more profitable.
One that, you know, even if there might be a lot of fuckery in the alternative health world, you know, like schemes and scams there, you know, one thing that is definitely missing, I think, from most people's understanding as a result of cherry picking and availability bias is like a holistic picture of health. Right? That health is, yeah, I mean, I think people get like eat right and exercise, but it's almost like so cliche that people don't integrate that in the picture of their whole health. And I think a really good example that takes us back to, you know, one of the prominent issues, the prominent issue of our time that I mentioned in a recent show called Follow the Science. And, you know, Daryl Becker and I did a whole episode about last year. I think you and I actually talked about this recently, germ versus terrain theory of disease. Right. So think about the cherry picking involved there. I think this is actually one of the best and most destructive examples of the media's role in this. The terrain theory of disease, the idea that the condition of your body based on lots of things that are inside your sphere of control has a major role to play in your susceptibility to disease and how you will fare with a disease. Almost entirely obscured from the narrative about the pandemic, right? Which is obviously the way the media and the government were going to play it. It was the way the pharmaceutical companies would certainly want it played. You are helpless and you are hopeless and you need to turn your will over to, you know, the authorities in this case. And that is your only prayer of staying safe. There is nothing you can wash your hands and you can maybe wear a mask, maybe don't wear a mask, maybe wear two, depending on who you ask and when, but there's very, very little you can do. And I think as you're watching a death ticker on CNN, the average uncritical person is definitely going to feel like they are a victim of a potential victim of fate in this whole thing.
Well, yeah. And that goes back to, there's all of these available solutions, but we're only going to make them aware of the one that we want them to take part in. So doing things that naturally uplift your spirit, working out, exercising, eating healthy, even just going for walks, smiling at people, hugging people, all of these things that are known to have health benefits. We're not even going to talk about those because we don't want people considering. What we want them to consider is the solution that we're going to provide for them. And we're going to make sure that in the news, any other available solutions are just not talked about or maybe even demonized and shunned, so that when it comes to deciding how am I going to deal with this, there's only one, with all of the availability bias, with all of the cherry picking, there's only one logical conclusion that you can come to, and that's the responsible one. And so, it happens everywhere. If you looked at how the media, if you looked at how the people responded over the last year, year and a half, there's so many marketing lessons that you can pull out of that. There's so many manipulation lessons that you can pull out of that. But there's one thing that we've seen over the last 20 years, I think, as the internet has evolved, and that is the shift in power dynamics. The amount of power that the consumer holds has now, for the first time that I can think of in history, the knowledge that the consumer is able to get, the amount of power that the consumer has going into a negotiation, going into making a deal, outweighs the seller. So a lot of times the consumer is at more of an advantageous position than the seller is. And as sellers, we don't like that. As sellers of worldviews, as sellers of products, as sellers of services, we don't like it when the consumer can come to us fully informed and we don't have this availability bias influence on their buying decisions, whether it's buying into what we want them to believe about the world or whether it's buying into our product or service. We don't like them having that type of power. We don't like the shift in the power dynamics to where they're the ones with the advantage in the negotiations process. And so I think that's why we've seen this increase of fact checkers, this increase of we've got to fight bad information. We've got to fight misinformation. We've got to censor certain political opinions or certain product opinions. We can't tell people about ivermectin, or we can't tell people about hydroxychloroquine, because we don't want people having all of the puzzle pieces when they go to make their buying decision about how they're going to solve this problem. And so right now, the availability of information has given the consumer of worldviews, of products, of services, has given them an amount of power that they've never had before. But us, as the producers of services, products, or worldviews, we don't like that shift in the power dynamic. So I think that that's why we're seeing that. I think that's the real reason for the push of stopping misinformation, stopping people from being able to put their opinions out on the internet. I don't think it's purely political. I think the reason why a lot of these big corporations haven't been pushing back is because they're just as invested in getting back to the old way of business, where the producers held all the power of which information was available. They don't like it any more than the politicians and the people with political aspirations like it.
All right. So I'm actually going to invoke the rusty and dusty old NPC meme right here, which I think is really, really relevant to what you're saying. So for anybody who is too young to remember the NPC meme, non-player character. So in a video game, there is somebody who is just kind of standing in the background, running a program, not really authoring their own actions, their own story, we could say. And it's perfectly summed up in the visual representation of this gray face, right? The NPC was this gray face. And I think what's really clever in that design is you have this textureless character, a character without texture. Just like we have all of these, because of cherry picking and availability bias, we have all of these textureless issues, right? That the texture is missing from everything. Everything is just very smooth and this or that, black or white, right? But not really any, color or radiance feel to it. I'm also reminded of a more textured example of the NPC meme is something that a guest on my show, this guy Skinner Lane, said. This was maybe 3 years ago. I did a show with him and Moritz Berling, and it was called The Deep Roots of Our Current Information Crisis. I'm trying to capture the essence of what he said, but it was something like the Enlightenment spawned communism and fascism, and then communism and fascism had a child that was consumerism. Now, if you think about what, you know, corporations and media, and this applies to politics too, the more textureless the individual is, the more non-individuated the individual is, the more the person will run a program put into them without questioning, the more useful that is to both media, which is putting out a product, and to large corporations. So, there's a lot of texture missing from the whole praise of the free market. This is not a free market. People are not educated to be free, and then they go out into this market to consume. And their behavior needs to be a certain way. It needs to be within certain parameters for what these large corporations do, right? And this, you could put this across almost every industry. So if you look at the attributes of communism and why they thought communism would work, and of course why it didn't, was because, there's no praxeological consideration. People need to behave like this for this to work. And they didn't. So it didn't work. But we still see, large corporations, I think, envisioning this kind of outcome for people. And the schools have been tasked with creating it. And the media companies reinforce it and benefit from it as well. The textureless individual who is non-individuated and not authoring his or her own story. Like you said, availability bias, or the harnessing of availability bias and the constraining of the whole picture, makes it so much easier to pull off on a massive scale.
So I think while it's still available to us, one of the best things that we can do is understand how this works and take advantage of the fact that there are competing narratives that we can go out and consume. If you're looking for a particular product and you go to my website and I sell it, or one of my clients sells it, and you look for the testimonials, I'm going to cherry pick the testimonials. I'm not going to put the testimonial up that says, yeah, I bought this product and it was okay, but it didn't really work for me. And you probably shouldn't buy it if you're like me. If those testimonials exist, I'm not putting them on my website. I'm cherry picking the ones that say, man, this was so easy and it did exactly what I wanted. And the outcome was amazing. And then the other one that I'm going to put on there is, yeah, this was the best solution for it. I tried other ones and this one was way better. And the other one that I'm going to cherry pick is, man, for me, this was the exact thing that I was looking for. Thank God for this business and this company. I'm going to cherry pick which testimonials you get to look at while you're making your decision on whether you're going to buy it. The best thing that you can do is go and look up other people who say, oh no, that was a scam. Just if you're thinking about buying something and you're really convinced because you saw a YouTube video or you read a sales page, open up another browser and say, type in the name of that product and then type the word scam after it or type the word ripoff after it and actually go and look at people who have different points of view. And this is what gives you power as a consumer. It also gives you power as somebody who's trying to figure out what's going on in the world. If something, again, back to what we talked about earlier, if something really strikes a nerve and you're just like, yes, I love hearing this, just take a second, type it in to your search bar, and then look for people who have, type in this and then type in the word bullshit afterwards and see who says this is bullshit and listen to what they're saying. And by simply doing that, you're drastically reducing the impact that people who control cherry pick the information for you, you're drastically reducing the impact that availability bias can have on leading you to make bad decisions in life.
Yes, that is one of the most useful hacks of the 21st century. If something excites you and it feels even like mildly too good to be true, bullshit, scam, or debunked, add that to your search terms and explore.
Yeah.
Save me money.
So all that to say this concept that we've kind of done a deep dive into, this is just one aspect of kind of taking more control over your mind and not being so susceptible to being manipulated by people. And we're putting together Summit Mindset and Mastery. And this is just kind of like a deep dive on one of the subjects that we're going to be talking about. The whole thing is going to be all about this, though, all about how to defend yourself from being manipulated, how to make sure that other people aren't exercising more control over your life than you have over your own life. And I think we're also going to be diving into some of the, you mentioned earlier, a lot of the stuff that we put on autopilot, because we can't just constantly be critically thinking about everything that comes after us or comes at us. Sometimes we have to say, okay, these things I run on autopilot. These things get my attention and energy. And a lot of those things that we put on autopilot, they maybe don't serve us the best. Maybe we haven't re-examined them in a long time. Maybe they were programmed by ourselves at a time where we didn't have as much information and knowledge about the world. Maybe they were programmed into us by the media or marketing agencies or politicians or teachers or parents who wanted to make us easier to manage. Exploring all of those things, finding ways to rewrite those programs to better propel you forward rather than hold you back, and finding ways to defend yourself against the manipulation of others is kind of what this whole program is about. So I just wanted to, at the end of this, plug, if you did get a kick out of this conversation, if you get a kick out of trying to hack ways to take more control over your own life and your own destiny, that's kind of what this whole Mindset and Mastery Summit is about. And so just to, as we're ending this, I definitely wanted to plug mindsetandmastery.com and let people know we're going to be going live next Monday and Tuesday. And if they don't get in before we go live, they're not going to be able to get access to this training.
Yeah, absolutely. And man, I would just be so excited one day. We certainly plan to build a larger community and a larger course around this. And just being able to have like a group discussion about this or so many of these unnamed things, right, that affect us negatively, and finding examples together really, really excites me. The kind of brain trust or mastermind that we would be able to create in a group of people working cooperatively and with accountability, you know, especially if some people have a better handle on this than other people, and think about all these internal and external programs that we run that hold us back. I just really, really am excited to, you know, build this community as a follow-up to this work that I've been doing with School Sucks. So this, you know, Mindset and Mastery Summit is definitely the first step to getting involved with that.
Yeah, man, it seems like the natural next step to what all of this work has been leading to. So that's, for me, that's kind of the most exciting thing, is we're taking what we've been teaching and we're turning it into an actual community. So if people want to be a part of this, if people want to add their two cents, connect with other people who are involved or intrigued by these type of ideas, definitely check out Mindset and Mastery and mindsetandmastery.com.
That's going to be great. I can't wait to see that.